So we're back for the last part of our podcast on changes in the global economy, which is geopolitical events and trends. And we want to talk a little bit more about how different occurrences, trends, and changes in relations or power dynamics might have implications for the global economy and whether or not we can expect power to shift away from certain key actors and states in the global economy. And I want to maybe focus it on certain regions or examples to ground the discussion. A very good point was made in the first part of our podcast about the US relying on China for political stability in Asia, particularly with North Korea, and how South Korea and Japan might be easy targets for a belligerent North Korea. What that could mean for trade relations and diplomatic relations between those countries is very important. Obviously, the Middle East, given the multiple conflicts going on in the region and the vested interests of not only the West but Russia and Iran and Saudi Arabia as kind of local aspiring hegemons, what that might have to do with different commodities. So, if anybody wants to start us off, Meg.
Touching on the China situation, and I did mention this in the first podcast, but I think it is a huge implication to a possible economic change. I mean, as we've seen in the past, whoever holds political power does hold a lot of economic power as well. So right now we're seeing the US kind of having to rely on a lot of different countries to settle their political fights, I guess, or political instability. And so right now we've got China and the US, Trump, talking about starting a trade war with China, and then, saying that kind of using his Trump is using the US trade and possible new develop or new newly developed trade deals with China as incentive for China to help stable US new possible warfare between North Korea and the US. And so China is now in sort of a real position of power economically, because they do now hold the power to say, okay, well, we will help you with this, but we want this trade deal, or we want to do this with our current economic setup. So they, as long as they've got someone relying on them, they hold a lot of economic power, and arguably more than the US right now. And you're seeing it too with Russia. This is kind of a side deal here, but they're relying on Russia now to calm that war for them and subdue Iran. So now they're giving Russia sort of a power in a sense. For like they need them to settle these potential catastrophic wars.
So a point comes to mind on strategic relationship building and Trump as the businessman, quote unquote. This is an idea that's been around forever, way before he even ran for president, that he's the guy who wants to make the deal happen. And the political implications for him as president is that he is going to have a transactional relationship with people, more so than a value-based relationship that Barack Obama or Bill Clinton might have had. Anyway, let's get back to the discussion at hand. Does anyone else have a follow-up point?
There are a few, yeah. Okay, well, let me speak about the United States for a few minutes, I guess, because it's the most pivotal player still. It has a lot to do with the fact that obviously the United States is the world's biggest economy by any measure. Well, actually, that's not entirely true, not by purchasing power, but anyway. But more importantly, it's the world's reserve currency, which means that many countries around the world buy US Treasury bonds to invest in because it's seen as a safe investment. That has allowed the United States to run very large current account deficits for many, many years, decades even. And that's allowed it to the people of the United States to purchase more than they export. And this relates to this this boogeyman of the trade deficit that Donald Trump talks about in regards to China and Mexico and stuff like that. But it's naturally because Americans are more affluent, and so they can afford to purchase things rather than sell. But the price of that over time, this accumulation, is that there is a debt that builds up. And this relates to another big trend that we've been seeing for 4 decades now, really, is that of growing wealth disparity in the United States and in the world. But as it pertains to the United States specifically, and there's a good quote from The Economist magazine that sums up why this is a problem, among other, there are political problems to it too, we can get to those in a moment, but it says here, quote, "Because the rich are less inclined to spend an extra dollar than the typical worker, this shift in resources, that is disparity, creates weakness in American demand and sluggish economic growth, except when consumer debt rises as the rich lend their purchasing power to the rest," unquote. So what that means is that as wealth accumulates in the hands of a few, people need to subsidize their spending by turning to credit.
Mm-hmm.
And that has pretty bad ramifications because, well, like the quote mentioned, it hurts economic growth as the velocity of money is reduced because rich people save more money, and it's an inefficient use of the money supply, basically. And so there's a late Italian academic named Giovanni Arrighi, who wrote a book, many books, but one of his books is called Adam Smith in Beijing, in which he mentions this theory of, quote, systemic cycles of accumulation. And basically what it means is that a given state gains a productive advantage. In this case, the United States became the world's hegemon after World War II, and especially at the end of the Cold War with the fall of the Soviet Union, became a unipolar world. So the United States had a big advantage in terms of military might, and after the other productive economies got destroyed in World War II, it was didn't have very much competition, so it could really make use of this golden age of economics in the 50s, 60s. So it became a hegemon, but then it later proceeds through predictable phases of crisis and decline. And the first crisis he identifies is what's called a signal crisis. That's when global finance stops seeing the central hegemon as a good place for investment, and that leads to capital flight. And Arrighi identified the 1973 oil shock as the United States signal crisis, where OPEC was formed and they raised oil prices dramatically. And that was a shock to the American economy and a lot of economies because supply chains rely on transporting things. And when the price of fuel is more expensive, that makes everything more expensive. Those costs get passed on to the consumer, and then people's purchasing power is reduced because things become more expensive in relation to their wages, you see. So that hinders economic growth. And then the second crisis is what's called a terminal crisis, where, as Vijay Prashad says, the contradictions of the country can no longer be managed. And so it turns to money lending, deficit spending, and war profiteering to conceal the crisis, the underlying crisis of overaccumulation. And that crisis, in theory, portends the hegemon's decline over a long-term period. And indeed, that's what we're seeing. It can explain the rise of Donald Trump in the United States, this populist brand of economics where he points the finger at ethnic groups.
Back to the conversation on openness, right?
Exactly. He misses the real causes of the malaise, though, which is mainly automation and competitiveness in other places. And so that speaks to how investors no longer see the United States as the future. It's the past. We're seeing that right now. And it's important to recognize that automation is the number one cause of this, because for every job lost overseas in the United States, 8 have been lost to automation. But you don't hear Donald Trump declaring war on the robots. So it just shows that this brand of politics is not addressing the correct causes of right. People's frustrations.
And perhaps neither has the, I guess, established Bretton Woods liberal brand, which really gives us a lack of options in terms of political solutions to potential economic crisis. Meg, you had your hand up.
Yeah, this is going a bit in a different direction, but you did mention, you know, the investment in developing nations. Like, I think that's a big indicator of possible economic shifts. You know, as you look back in history, you see colonialism and how the U.S. And while mainly Britain would take over nations and become the big economic power because they can assert their own soft power or hard power into developing countries. And we're seeing that in China in a very soft way, oftentimes, anyways. As we mentioned, you know, in the first podcast, China and Africa, mainly their benefit for being in Africa is creating infrastructure. And this goes back to oil as well, that, you know, China in Canada, well, they tried to buy a mine. And of course, it was, I think it was vetoed because we do have quite a bit of regulations in Canada. But the assertion of soft power to kind of gain resources and possibly economic power through, you know, investments that do look friendly and maybe are in a lot of times the best interest for both countries. But in a lot of cases, China has gained a lot of power from just, you know, building a road or building a railway in Africa, which helps them get resources, and they also get their money back because they've got, you know, the debt from their investment. Yeah.
That's actually why the British wanted to build a railway that goes entire north-south axis of Africa from Egypt to the Cape Coast. But that's an aside. Just an interesting historical parallel to a current phenomenon. Ross, did you want to speak?
Yeah. As an aside, I had sort of two thoughts, and I'll split them up, one for Brad and one responding to sort of the more geopolitical stuff about Megan. Brad, I wanted to pick up on your points, because it sounded like you were addressing broadly some of the issues to do with economic malaise in the West and some of the structural weaknesses that Western economies face. And as you said, fundamentally, it seems like the problem is largely of slow growth, stagnant wages, and the issue of not having a response to technological change that will probably drive up unemployment in the years ahead. And as you said, the populist economics at present are not only misdiagnosing the problem as one resulting from immigration and population shifts as opposed to technological change, but that populist economics also provides the wrong prescription in the form of greater isolation and spending on areas that are probably poorly targeted to expanding the tax base or addressing holes in the welfare system. The other problem, structurally, is that we do not have the same kind of monetary leverage to address these problems that we once did. This is something that affects North America as well as Europe. In North America, the issue is primarily that interest rates are rock bottom and can't really go much lower. And so the typical tools to stimulate demand and consumption really aren't there. The problem's even worse in Europe, where the European Central Bank is in some case offering negative interest rates, which is why the government of France, for example, is essentially being paid to borrow money. The French Treasury is able to borrow money at about negative 0.25 interest. The lack of those tools is also reflected in the kinds of economic platforms you see, whether it's Donald Trump promising to revitalize the U.S. economy by returning to coal mining, which, as you said, is not exactly the best response to a technologically shifting world, or looking at the platforms in France, where you have one candidate promising to shut off immigration and another one saying the answer is austerity and another saying the answer is Keynesian economics. In all of those cases, you have 20th century problems to, or 20th century answers to 21st century structural problems.
Yes.
And in all the cases, we don't have the tools necessary.
So perhaps then what we're going to see is a necessary change to the global economy, not necessarily one that emerges from particular social or political phenomena, but one that is simply the global economy needing to catch up to how it's being structured in particular cases, since we're so globally connected. If, as you said, the tax base can't keep up, or if the solutions can't keep up to the problems we're facing, then eventually it's going to be adapt or die. Again, perhaps a cynical approach, perhaps a social Darwinist approach to a complex social institution or series of institutions that is our global economy, but that seems to be the underlying tone of the commentary in this section. I don't know if anyone has any final thoughts, but I did want to wrap this up.
Just
okay, Ross and then Brad.
I suppose I'll be very brief. A reply to Megan's thoughts. You've touched on a couple of issues. mostly dealing, obviously, with the impact of shifting power toward China in the future. And that's something that's significant, not only because of China's economy growing and China's political power growing, but I'm very curious to see what will happen over the course of the Trump administration, since the president seems to have abdicated the United States' typical role, not only in terms of its values-based approach, but even financially. The president is suggesting that the United States will step back from backing its allies and global institutions with the kind of hard cash that the U.S. has been used to doing. And as you said, that's something China has been very willing to do, whether that's in Africa or whether that's in Southeast Asia. The Chinese government has been handing out money left, right, and center to various actors in order to pursue its political aims. And that's something that the United States has equally done. But what President Trump doesn't seem to recognize is that a lot of America's power has been balanced on the back of its checkbook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brad?
Yeah, some final thoughts to cap off what we were talking about a moment ago about perhaps some potential solutions to this, because you were saying, Ross, that these are indeed 20th century solutions being propounded to purportedly address 21st century problems, which doesn't look like they'll work. I mean, the one solution that's gaining steam, I think, that's thought of more commonly now is that of a universal basic income, which appears to be probably inevitable, at least in my view, for a couple of reasons. In 2012, there was a pretty famous study out of Oxford University that said that within the next 2 decades, remember this was 5 years ago this study was done, so basically in the next 15 years now, 47% of the jobs in the United States economy are at high risk of being automated. Okay. And more recently, a study was done for the Canadian economy, which said the same thing, but 40% of the Canadian economy is at high risk of being automated. So the question is, where are those people going to work? Are they going to work? It's not clear how new jobs will be created to bring in the people who are low skilled, because let's face it, those are the people who get replaced first, the things that a robot can do the job of instead. But, you know, those people are not computer engineers. They're not going to be able to take the jobs that are created to manage this new technology. So it provides a pretty big problem for macroeconomic theory, because demand that keeps the economy, move money flowing through the economy, will break down if there are not people making money that they can use to spend on things to keep the money going. It's a chicken and an egg problem. So you have to find a way to get money into the hands of those people to keep the economy going. And it's impossible, really, to see how it'll be done unless there's a pretty significant redistribution of wealth mandated through political choices that we'll have to make. Mm-hmm. That would be because at present, you know, the conventional wisdom is to use Keynesianism. But Vijay Prashad, this guy I keep talking about, he's a professor at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, I think. He talks about how this idea of military Keynesianism, where we're kind of locked in this seemingly endless concatenation of wars, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq or Yemen or wherever, and it provides some boon to arms manufacturers in the United States who always have a market to sell to in perpetuity. And that brings money into the United States because there are a lot of key Senate districts where Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Northrop Grumman employ tens of thousands of people in the United States, and those people need jobs. Therefore, we need war to keep them employed. You see, now it's still not another brand of trickle down economics, good old Reaganomics from the 80s. It's been refreshed, but like if that's the best idea we have, it ain't looking good for the future, you know.
Yeah. So there's a really interesting insight that I glean from this, which is that, based on the idea of outdated solutions to new problems, military Keynesianism is adapting. It's adapting, I guess, that Bretton Woods style of construction and development and American production for a global market to a new frontier, which might be perpetuating conflict, or it might be reestablishing a balance of power, depending on how you look at it. This is not a conversation on IR theory, so I don't want to get into that too much. But it seems to me that perhaps there has been too much of a cling to old solutions, and that is the reason, I mean, that was Ross's point, but that is one of the things actually inhibiting change in the global economy. positive change that may allow us to adapt to all these other factors that we've discussed in terms of shifts in identity that may threaten openness, in terms of changing technology and demographics, and in terms of geopolitical realignments. This kind of seems to be the thread that weaves through all these themes, and I'm really glad that it came up. Ross, did you want to say something? I'm going to make this be the final
one final thought, which is that I think all of this unease and uncertainty and the questions of openness and outdated solutions, I think all speaks to the tremendous uncertainty that we face in the world of today. And I think it is contributing to a great degree of ideological incoherence and confusion. We have misdiagnosis of economic problems. We have political groupings that transcend the typical left and right divisions. We have populist insurgencies that our establishments are unable to cope with. And the pairing of old solutions with new problems is, I think, a natural result of this kind of confusion that we see in the world today. And it makes sense that when voters and politicians no longer know how to make sense of the problems they face, we're going to get similarly confused responses that do not map very well to the politics or the problems that we're used to seeing.
Now, to end this off, I want to present a quote that I've heard quite a few times over the past few months from my colleagues at the NATO Association, which is that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Some of you may have heard this quote. I don't remember who said it first. It might be one of those, like, Stalin said a million people is a tragedy type deal, or a million people is a statistic where you can't prove that he said it. Anyways, there's a huge echo of the past wherein financial turmoil in the interwar period in the 20th century, and even before that in the lead up to World War I, leaders used 19th century ideas to combat 20th century problems and ended in horrific tragedy, if I might be blunt. Now, I'm not saying that the same thing might happen, because we've had completely new developments, both ideologically and institutionally, in our world since the two world wars, but it certainly speaks to not only uncertainty, but the fact that this is just the beginning of a potentially new way that international relations will play out and that the global economy will play out. So that might be the takeaway that I want to give to all of us and to our listeners. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad to all of you at the International Business and Economics section for taking the time to sit down with me and discuss these issues. I think there were a lot of things that we went over that might be useful to different people or just interesting. And I'm really thankful to the audience for listening. So without further ado, that will be the end of our little endeavor into this global economy.
Yeah. Thanks for organizing.
Thank you.
Yeah.